Peter chapter 1, verses 19 through 21. We used this last week. I'm going to use it this week as our text. 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 19 through 21. And so we have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed, as a light that shines in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. Knowing this first, that no prophecy of the Scripture is of any private interpretation. For prophecy never came by the will of man, but holy men of God spoke as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. Long time ago, this is, years and years ago, Sandy and I, with three kids, before Tim was born, lived in Rogers. And this was on a Wednesday night. We were studying in the Old Testament on Wednesday night in the auditorium class. And we had a visiting preacher from California. He just spoke up during that Wednesday night Old Testament class and let everybody know that he probably knew the New Testament as well as anybody alive. Now, he might have said that word for word, but that's definitely the way it came across. But that he just didn't see any sense at all in studying the Old Testament. That was just a waste of time. And I was a kid preacher at the time. I was just flabbergasted. I think I probably just stood there with my mouth open, you know. I couldn't believe that a man that called himself a preacher of the gospel had actually made that statement. But, you know, there are people who just have a little bit of knowledge of the Church of Christ, think that members of the Church of Christ don't believe in the Old Testament. In fact, I told you last week, and this also happened when I was over there at Rogers calling on folks, a lady greeted me at the door after I told her, you know, who I was and why I was there. We had a program which we welcomed newcomers to town. And she said, "Oh, you're one of those folks that don't believe in the Old Testament." No, ma'am, I'm not one of them. I believe with all my heart that the Old Testament is inspired of God. But we have to use it in the way that the Lord intended it. Now, I believe that we established last week that the Old Testament is not our law. It's not the standard by which we shall be judged. The standard by which we shall be judged, our law, is the New Testament, the law of Christ. But that doesn't mean that the Old Testament does not have any use for us. It has a great deal of use for us. Now, I have five ways that I have in my mind that we can use the Old Testament, and we should use it. And I hope this will establish that we ought to be studying. When we're studying, for example, the book of Isaiah on Wednesday night, that's a very worthwhile study. It's a very helpful study. Well, why is that so? Well, there are at least five things that I have been able to find from the New Testament that are uses, proper uses of the Old Testament to give us the incentive that we ought to study, learn, and know the Old Testament. And maybe you could come up with some ideas for others. This is one that I just recently added, and I may come up with a better way of expressing this, but I think you'll get the idea. Turn to Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, please. Galatians chapter 4, verse 4. The Apostle Paul says, "But when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law." What I want you to see is that happened in the fullness of the time that Jesus came. Now, what does it mean in the fullness of the time? Well, of course, primarily it simply means at the time when God had planned ahead from all eternity that His Son would come to this earth. But in keeping with that, God in His all-wise nature, God in His all-powerful nature, had so ordered all the events of mankind that everything was perfectly prepared for the coming of His Son. There's many things that I could point out about that I won't take the time to do so. But when we study the Old Testament, particularly Old Testament history, what we see is the gradual unfolding of God's great plan of salvation, His scheme of redemption. And I think that's a good reason to study the history portion of the Old Testament. You could study it from the standpoint of going back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, and coming forward from there in the promises of the coming of Christ and the preparation for the coming of Christ. And you know, I studied with you Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, the Abrahamic promise, and then verse 7. And I hope you might remember that when we studied that Abrahamic promise, that we saw that promise outlines the entire Old Testament. And then it ties the Old Testament to the New Testament. And so I think this is a great faith-building exercise. If you can step off and get the big picture, see how God throughout all history, from Adam and Eve on down, properly understood, properly studied, is the gradual unfolding of God's plan of salvation when it finally came to complete perfection and fulfillment, when in the fullness of the time, when everything was ready, when God had prepared everything over thousands and thousands of years, using nations of people that didn't even believe in Him. When we study Isaiah chapter 10, we're going to study about Assyria, the rod of God. And the Assyrians didn't even believe in God. And God said, they're just a rod in my hand. That's all they are. They think they're doing all this themselves. And I'm just using them like a father would use a rod to punish his son. I'm using Assyria as a rod to punish Israel. And they didn't even know He existed. And so all of this is the gradual unfolding of God's great plan, God's great scheme. And I would like maybe someday, if we have time, there's so many things we need to study as we have time to do these things, to go back and look at the periods of Bible history and look at, again, this gives us an overview of it. Sometimes we break down Bible history into 20 periods. But what we see in all of this is the gradual unfolding until, in the fullness of the time, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law. So I think that's a very worthwhile reason to study the Old Testament. It gives us that. I just step back and get chill bumps when I think about, what a powerful, how wise, how awesome is our God, who can over thousands of years use all the people of history just to work out to send a little baby into this world, born of Mary in Bethlehem, and then from Him to bring salvation to all mankind. Isn't that a wonderful thing? That just is so awesome to me to consider. And that's how that's a beginning place in studying the Old Testament, see in it the unfolding of the scheme of redemption. But go back to Isaiah again. Isaiah, more than any of the other Old Testament prophets, foretold the coming of the Christ. And Jesus challenged the Jews of His day, the Jewish leaders who were supposed to know the law, in John chapter 5, verse 39. This is a challenge that Jesus is throwing out to them. He said, you search the Scriptures. Now, when He said Scriptures, He meant the Old Testament. That's all the Scriptures there were at that time. He said, you search the Scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they which testify of Me. I have a book at the house that identifies about 300 different Old Testament prophecies that are fulfilled in Jesus of Nazareth. Now, some of those you have to take the word of the New Testament writers, because you might not see immediately how they do. And I would not use them as evidence. I believe that they do because the New Testament writers say so, but I would not use them as evidence. But there are some which are so overwhelmingly plain that I just throw them out to an unbeliever and challenge them. You explain that passage other than say, that is the foretelling of Jesus Christ. You study Isaiah chapter 53 when we get there. It actually, the context begins in Isaiah chapter 52, verse 13, and goes down to the end of chapter 53, which is only 13 verses long. And in those 15 verses is the foretelling, over 700 years before it happened, the foretelling of Jesus' death in our behalf. Not just a death, but what's called a vicarious death. One dying for others. And it's just told very plainly there. And I've often said, and I hope maybe someday I might have the opportunity to do this, if I were to be able to stand before an audience of unbelieving Jews and could only speak to them one time, what would I do? I'd just go through Isaiah chapter 53. So there it is. You tell me what that means. That's your Scripture. You say you believe that. You tell me what that means if that's not Jesus of Nazareth. I can do the same thing with Psalm 22. Do the same thing with Psalm 110. Do the same thing with Psalm 16. And other passages from the Old Testament that just are so plain in their foretelling of what Jesus did for us, even where He was born. How in the world would somebody... Can you plan ahead where you were born? You can't hardly plan where you're going to be born, can you? But all of those things are just plainly foretold in the Old Testament prophets, and they're just such powerful, overwhelming evidence that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, that we get from a study of the Old Testament Scriptures. And something else that maybe you haven't thought about But if we study the Old Testament scriptures properly, they become a basis for our hope. The Apostle Paul specifically said that in Romans chapter 15, verse 4. This is Romans chapter 15, verse 4. He says, "For whatever things were written before..." Well, that's the Old Testament. That's what was written before. Now, why were they written? They're written for our learning. Now, that preacher from California said he saw no sense in studying the Old Testament. He knew the New Testament. Well, he didn't know the Old, New Testament very well. Because Paul in Romans, that's the New Testament, said, whatever things written before, written for our learning, that we through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures. Now, wait a minute. That's odd language. Do the Scriptures have patience? No, that's something we have. But the Scriptures do give us comfort. But how does the... that we through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Well, the Old Testament Scriptures, that's what he's talking about in this context, is things written before. They give us the incentive to endure. That's what patience is in this passage, is endurance, steadfastness. They give us the incentive to be steadfast, to endure. And that if we will do this, they give us the comfort that God will bless us. Let's go back and give the example of God's promise to Abraham as an example of this. You remember, God made three promises to Abraham in Genesis 12, 1 through 3 and verse 7. He promised that his seed would become a great nation. He promised that his seed would inherit the land of Canaan. And he promised that through him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Well, now, Abraham lived close to 2,000 years before the time when Jesus walked upon this earth. So it took 2,000 years for God to completely fulfill that promise. But did God completely fulfill the promise? Yes, he did. Every bit of it was completely fulfilled. And so what we learn is, if we... Now, Abraham had to endure a lot of things, didn't he? Did God ever tell you to take your son up to a mountain and offer him as a sacrifice? I'm glad God never told me to do that. I can't think of anything that would be a greater test of my faith. But Abraham endured, and so after he had patiently endured, this is what the writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews 11, after he patiently endured, he obtained the promise. And so we, if we will have patience, see, the Old Testament teaches us endure. Keep on keeping on regardless of the temptation to fall away, regardless of how hard it is, regardless of how many things that you have to step over as far as the stumbling block, you keep on enduring and God will fulfill His promise. You will inherit eternal life. Because if anything we ought to be able to see from the Old Testament, God is faithful. God will keep His end. You know, when it comes to the matter of falling away, I'm not worried about God's part of it. I'm worried about my part of it. Okay, I know God will fulfill His part. I've just got to fulfill my part. So if I will patiently endure, God will be faithful. He will bless me as He has promised that He will. So that gives us the hope. That gives us the blessed hope that if we just keep on enduring, then God will in the end bless us. The Old Testament is a shadow of things to come. I think this is something that is peculiar, especially of the law. Specifically, I'm talking about those books that were written by Moses that were given to direct Israel and how they were to live. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. In Hebrews chapter 8, verses 4 and 5, the inspired writer, and he's writing to Jewish Christians, telling them to be faithful to the Lord. Don't turn back to Judaism. The Lord is better. And so these people would understand the figure that he's using here. And he says concerning Jesus, "For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest." This is Hebrews 8, 4 and 5. "If he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve," now notice carefully in verse 5, "who serve the copy and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle, for he said, 'See that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain.'" I can still remember the first sermon I ever preached in the pulpit. I was 18 years old. And my brother and I drove together to Etna, Arkansas. Everybody here knows where Etna is, don't you? Well, it's south of Ozark, across the Arkansas River, south of Ozark, out in the country. And I preached my first sermon in the pulpit. And when I got through, I asked Sonny, my brother, well, how'd I do? He said, well, if you'd slowed down, you'd been all right. I was too nervous. I couldn't slow down. But my first sermon that I ever preached in the pulpit was the tabernacle in the church. And I still have that outline, by the way. Not any good, but still have the outline. But, well, I wouldn't preach it now anyway. It would take me a month to preach that thing. Now I preached it in 25 minutes then. But the point is, what I did was go through the second half of the book of Exodus in one sermon. And you have all these details about the Old Testament tabernacle, and you women have taught that in children's class. I suspect you women know the details of the tabernacle better than I do, okay? Because you've taught that to the children in the children's classes. And then all of those details are copy and shadow of the New Testament. That's the reason the tabernacle and the church, we, the Lord's church, are the tabernacle or the temple today. And each of those things in that temple has a counterpart in the Lord's church. And what the Lord was doing to the Jews, we talk about a sneak preview. He was giving them a sneak preview of what the new covenant and the things the new covenant would be like. And he treated them just the way we treat the children in the little kids' Bible class. We had to be brought along that way too. Because you take physical things that they can see and touch, and that helps them to get the concept of those things that they can't see and touch. The things that have to do with the spiritual. And so God took Israel as babes, and he gave them physical things they could see and touch. The tabernacle and all the worship, the priests that surrounded the tabernacle, and those pictured for Israel the spiritual reality. And you know, here's the exact opposite. We think of, well, the shadow is something that you can't touch. It's something that's almost spiritual. Not really spiritual, but almost. Whereas the physical, that's the real. But with God, it's the opposite. The physical is the shadow. The spiritual is the real. And all that shadow was the Old Testament tabernacle and the things that pertain to it. And you know, you can learn a lot of good. Now, the inspired writer of Hebrews teaches us one of the great lessons of the New Testament right here. When he says, as Moses was divinely instructed, when he was about to make the tabernacle, for he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. Moses was given a very detailed pattern. Have you read there in the second half of the book of Exodus? Probably you have several times. And every time I read that, I try to picture. Now, not picture what somebody drew for me to make it easy, okay? But try to picture from my reading of it what the tabernacle looked like. And I always just, I'm going to have to go get a picture out. I just cannot put that together. It's too complex. Too hard to put together in my mind. But Moses had to follow everything to the exact detail. Twice he's told to do that. In Exodus 25 verses 8 and 9. In Exodus chapter 25 verse 40. And then in Exodus chapter 39 it says they did it. They followed it exactly as Moses gave the pattern to them. And then in chapter 40 Moses blessed them. And the glory of God filled the tabernacle. So that Moses was not able to enter into the tabernacle because the glory of God so filled the tabernacle. No man, not even Moses, could enter when the glory of God filled the tabernacle. And oh, that's a great lesson. What does that teach us? We've got a pattern. The pattern in the new covenant is the pattern for our lives. It's the pattern for the church. It's the pattern for serving God under the new covenant. And you may think it's complicated. It actually is pretty simple. But our obligation is to follow it exactly, to reproduce exactly upon this earth that pattern that God demands of us. And if we will do that, the glory of God will fill His church. Now, I'm not talking about this building. You know that. The glory of God will fill His people. And we will be His people. He will watch over us and guide us to that land of promise we wait for. In fact, I thought about this as I was going over the lesson this afternoon. It sometime just to go through quickly the book of Exodus. And maybe you can have a picture of the book of Exodus in your mind and see how many lessons are gained from just the book of Exodus that apply to us today. Now, you see, for example, the 10 plagues upon Egypt. Great lessons there for us. And God delivered Israel and purchased, and the firstborn became his because God delivered the firstborn of the Israelites. And see, there's the first, 10 chapters, I think, of the book of Exodus. But there's the call of Moses. Oh, there's a great lesson there. Moses made all kinds of excuses. And on, I'll stop because I'm about to start going through the book of Exodus. But we don't have time to do that. But all those wonderful lessons. Now, they don't directly apply to us, but the principles do apply. So there's the copy and shadow of the things to come. And then, of course, this leads into this. There's the wonderful examples that are examples that we need to learn that teach us great lessons. This is the best way that we teach our children. And, you know, Brother Les Maydell is a friend of mine. He's a native of South Africa. He grew up Catholic, was converted to the Lord, and became a preacher of the gospel. He's just a great man. And I've stayed in his home and worked with him. And he has been of help to me in trying to preach to and teach Africans, because he's lived there his entire life and he understands more how Africans think. African people, because of their culture, don't think the same way that we do. If you want to convince me of something, you give me, of course, book, chapter, and verse, but give me logic. You know, major premise, minor premise, conclusion, and I'll consider your logic and waste of time on an African. Just don't even get started there. Just tell a story that illustrates your point. And that's how they learn. How do we learn best? Who had you rather listen to? Somebody stands up here and gives you major premise, minor premise, conclusion. Or somebody gives you a Bible story that illustrates the point and then brings the point home. Now, everybody rather had that second type kind, hadn't you? And that's the way we teach in Africa. A year and a half ago, I was over in Uganda, in southern Uganda on Lake Victoria. Brother John Welch and I, his first trip to Africa, and I was going to teach him all the ropes. He wound up teaching me some things. But I was teaching some young men who wanted to preach. We started out with 20 young men in our class. Maybe one or two of them spoke enough English that you could say good morning to them. And maybe several of them were completely illiterate. And they wanted to preach. And dumb me, I showed up with this workbook on the book of Acts, about that thick, that I'd written. Boy, I'm going to teach those guys some things. Of course, I never got past page one. I threw that workbook away. I said, what am I going to do? And John, tell them the stories. What is the book of Acts? It's a bunch of stories. And we went through the examples of salvation, the cases of conversion of the book of Acts. And I want you to know, it's a success story. Not thanks to me. Okay. At the end of the 2 weeks of that class for young men who wanted to preach. Now, I didn't understand what they were saying. They were speaking Joppadello, and I don't even know what that is. But they told us just say Jop. But they were getting up and preaching like this. All of them were sitting on the edge of their seat to listen to what the other had to say. And they were preaching the case of conversion in the book of Acts. How do you teach them? Tell the Bible stories. That's how you teach them. That's how you teach young people. That's how you teach real well here. Well, now go over to Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. The inspired writer has gone through Hebrews 11, the roll call of the faithful, as my dad used to call it, or as I've heard some preachers call it, the hall of faith. And he's given us examples all the way from faithful Abel to people who are unknown to us, unnamed toward the end of chapter 11, of those who were saved by faith, the principle of salvation by faith. And then you come to chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, and he's summarizing what he said in chapter 11. He says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Oh, who's that cloud of witnesses? That's all those saints of old who were saved by faith, who lived by faith, and who died in faith. Since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with steadfastness the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down at the right hand of God. We are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. And I like to look upon that as, I think this is the figure speech that the inspired writer is using there. We are the runners in the stadium. We're running the marathon. The marathon is what, 26 miles some odd yards, or 300 some odd yards. And it's not a burst of speed, it's endurance. I heard about people hitting the wall. I don't know why anybody wants to run into a wall. But they just keep on and keep on. And what happens is they run out of blood sugar. And so they're completely out of any energy whatsoever until they start burning some fat. And then the blood sugar will kick back in and then they can revive. But when they're there with no blood sugar left, they don't have any energy to go. And they have to will themselves to put one foot in front of another. I know of a young woman who was an army wife up in northern New York who ran the marathon. And she ran into the wall. I told her, why do you want to run into a wall? It doesn't make any sense to me. But she hit the wall. But another young woman beside her talked her through it. And she just kept on putting one foot in front of another until finally started burning some fat and she was able to start jogging again. I would never got to where the wall was. But nonetheless, there's a figure for us, and this is, I believe, what the inspired writer is talking about. We're running the marathon. You can't just give a burst of energy, so you just got to keep on keeping on. And you're going to run into some walls while you're doing it. You'll run into several walls, aren't you? You're going to run into some things and say, I cannot take this. I've had all I can stand. I'm going to give up. I'm going to go out and live in the world. I'm through with this. Now, you'll run into that. I've run into that, and you'll run into that, and you probably run into that several times. But we've got a cloud of witnesses in the stadium above us. But this is a beautiful cloud of witnesses. This is the worthies of Hebrews 11. This are those who live by faith, saved by faith, died in faith, and they're cheering us on. Now, don't misunderstand me. He's not teaching that they can see him, and what this is just a figure of speech. That's all it is, just a figure of speech. But they're cheering us on, and they're saying, don't give up. Don't throw in the towel. Don't quit. We finished the race. We endured more than you've gone through, and you can finish the race too. Just look to Jesus, the author and finisher of the faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of God. And so we have in this Old Testament these wonderful examples of people who lived by faith, who died in faith, who were saved by faith, that are cheering us on, figuratively speaking. Now, I want to add to this a little bit. In James chapter 1, verse 17. James chapter 1, verse 17. James says, for every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of life, of whom there is no variance or shadow of turning. The point is, God never changes. God is the author of both the Old Testament and the New Testament. He gave the law that came through Moses. He gave the law that came through Christ. God's nature never, ever changes. People change. You've been disappointed in people, and you will continue from time to time to be disappointed because people change, don't they? Sometimes people are not what they appear to be, but sometimes people just change over time. And I've had people that I had a great deal of confidence in, that we worked together, that I loved dearly, and then over time, of course, primarily to let the Lord down, but to let down the brethren who were depending upon them, who trusted them. People change, but the Lord never, ever changes. He's always the same. So, his law springs from his nature. His nature doesn't change. So we should expect the Old Testament to be basically the same as the New Testament, so far as a moral standard, so far as a standard of how we are to live. And it is. But there are some differences, and here is the reason for the differences between the Old Testament standard of how people are to live and the New Testament standard. Well, let me give what Jesus said about it and then draw the conclusion. Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 9. Matthew 19, verses 3 through 9. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, and saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? He said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Therefore, they're no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts," there's key, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. God never intended for it to be that way. But I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." Now Moses, there's two differences that I want us to see from this passage concerning Moses' law concerning marriage and the law of Christ concerning marriage. There are differences, and this is important. Moses allowed polygamy. You can read in the book of Exodus, and there are even allowances that are made for if a man goes out to war. This can include a married man, sees a maiden that catches his eye, he can take her, and then the rules that he can be married to her, even though he might already have a wife. So Moses allowed polygamy, but Jesus went back to God's original plan. God made one man, one woman, and the two, not the three, not the four. The man and the woman, not the man and the man, not the woman and the woman. Woman and the man, the two, should become one flesh. So Jesus goes back to God's original plan. One man, one woman for life. Moses allowed divorce for some uncleanness. And that's much broader than sexual immorality. But Jesus, and by the way, the word there is the word fornication. It's porneia. And I wish the New King James had it very frankly the way the Old King James does. I believe the Old King James is right in the use of the word fornication. It's a specific thing. Jesus only allows divorce for one reason. Fornication. Now that is used in the broad sense that it includes sexual relationships both between married people if they don't have the right to be with one another and unmarried people. It includes both, okay? But the point is this. Jesus changed the law concerning marriage. It's not the same in the Old Testament and the New Testament. There's a higher moral standard. The Old Testament was the highest moral standard that had ever existed at the time it was given, but Jesus gave even a higher moral standard, his law, which is perfection of moral requirements. When he got through showing that in Matthew chapter 5, beginning verse 21, Jesus said several times, "You've heard that it was said to those of old, but I say to you," and when he got through, Matthew 5, verse 48, "You therefore should be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." Here is a perfect, a flawless, a sinless, a complete moral standard. If we follow that moral standard that is given by the Lord through His Son, Jesus Christ, we will be as perfect as God Himself for us. Our morals are concerned. Now then, there's a difference because of the hardness of their hearts. Moses, or God through Moses, took Israel as those who were immature, not ready to be returned to God's original plan, and gradually developed them until they were ready for Christ to come and to put God's perfect standard back in place. But generally speaking, the moral standard of the law is the equivalent of the moral standard of the law of Christ, except, remember, he was taking a people who they had hardness of heart, they're not ready, and so he had to bring them up and prepare them. And here's an application I think you can make of this. I know you can make of this. I'll go back to Matthew chapter 5 again. You've heard that it was said, "You shall not kill, but I say to whoever hates his brother," okay? So Jesus forbids the outward act just as the law did. But he goes back behind the outward act and he condemns the attitude and the angry words that lead to the outward act as well. Okay? And so that's the way that Jesus makes the standard, the higher standard, under the law of Christ. You see that difference? Moses just condemned the outward act. Jesus said, "You don't be angry with your brother." Jesus said, "You don't use those angry words. You don't call your brother a fool. You don't say Raka to your brother. You don't use those angry words. You don't do the things that would lead to that outward act of murder." But he did not change the definition of the outward act. The outward act, see, they didn't change the definition. They just told, he just forbid things that led to the outward act. The moral standard there, as far as the outward act, is the same. Now, here's a very definite conclusion and a true conclusion you can draw from that. When Moses said, "You shall not kill, thou shalt not kill," was the forbidden killing, did that include serving in the military and defending your country? Did it include using a sword as a law enforcement officer? No. God sent Israel into battle, didn't he? The kind of killing was the shedding of innocent blood. The kind of killing that was forbidden was murder. That's the reason, by the way, the New King James does translate that murder. Although the Old King James is right, it's the word kill. But nonetheless, what was forbidden is murder. The same thing is true under the New Testament. It's not wrong to serve in the law enforcement position. It's not wrong to serve in the military any more than it was under the Old Testament. The outward act remains the same. All right. I believe those are true conclusions that can be drawn from that. Now, there's some very important things we learn from the Old Testament, because the Old Testament is our example. We see the principle of salvation by faith exemplified. Before I go to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7, quickly, I want to tell you a story. I've got to hit this quickly. I think this was 1982, it may have been 81, but I was in a debate in Piggott with a Baptist preacher. And the Baptist preacher, I think he made an argument, if I remember correctly, on the thief on the cross, you know, that I talked about last or 2 weeks ago. And I pointed out to him, the thief on the cross lived before the New Testament was given. And the man said, "Oh, well, salvation is the same in every age. Why, we're saved the same way today that the thief on the cross was saved. We're saved the same way that the Hebrew children, as they call them, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we're saved the same way that that Noah was saved, that we're saved the same way that Abraham was saved." He didn't believe any more than I do. I pointed out that to him. And by the way, he dropped that argument. Because I pointed out to him, they were all saved without believing that Jesus Christ has been raised from the dead. But you and I cannot be saved without believing Jesus Christ has been raised from the dead. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1 through 4. He didn't believe any more than I do. But here is what is true concerning the Old Testament. The principle of salvation by faith has been the same in every age. The principle, now the specific requirements change, but the principle remains the same in every age. Hebrews 11, verse 7 will illustrate this. This is Noah. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world, became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Now, to summarize this quickly, God spoke, Noah believed, Noah obeyed, God saved. Now, the obedience of Noah was to build an ark according to the divine pattern. But that principle of salvation by faith is always true, and applies in every age, and it applies to us today, and it's always the same order. God speaks, we believe, we obey, God saves. That principle of salvation by faith never, ever changes. Well, one other thing, and then we'll draw the lesson to a close. The Old Testament is so very, very plain, so forceful in illustrating to us the danger of disobedience. And the danger of disobedience includes the danger of partial obedience and the danger of doing things God has not authorized. Old Testament Israel's wandering in the wilderness. This would cover most of the book of Numbers. Old Testament Israel's wandering in the wilderness is such a forceful example of the danger of falling that is used over and over again in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 13, that's what it's about. Hebrews chapters 3 and 4, that's what it's about, is Old Testament Israel wandering in the wilderness. 603,550 Israelite soldiers set out from Egypt, according to Numbers chapter 1, I believe it's verse 46. And how many of those men above the age of 20, fit for war, other than the Levites, finally made it to Canaan? Out of 603,550, Kay said it, two. Joshua and Caleb. Now that will get your attention. If anything will get your attention. 603,550 people who set out under the guidance of God and who saw God manifest himself in that cloud, that smoke, that earthquake, and the lightning and the thunder on the top of Mount Sinai, and with his own voice give the Ten Commandments. 603,550 set out, and 2 made it to Canaan. And what's the point of all that for us? By the way, that's Hebrews 3 as well as 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10 verses 11 and 12, "Now all these things happen to them for examples, and they're written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." We live in the last age. They're recorded for our example. Therefore, and here's the conclusion, "Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Now, by the way, there follows the comfort that you don't have to fall. "There will no temptation take you, but such as is common to man. God is faithful to not allow you to be tempted above that. You're able with temptation also to make the way to escape, that you may be able to bear it." That's verse 13. But here's the point. When you read those Old Testament examples and you see how Israel repeatedly failed, don't just look down your nose and shake your head in disgust to Israel. Think, "That may be me. That could be us as God's people, as the church." The church also goes through the same thing as Israel did in the book of Joshua, over and over again, turning to rebel against God, God punishing them, they're repenting, God delivering them, then they turn right around and turn against him again. Over and over again, they just happen into the book of Judges, and that's what the Lord's church does. You read the history of the Lord's church, and what you see is the same thing you see in the book of Judges. People turning away from God, God bringing punishment, people repenting, God delivering them, and then turning right to the same cycle over again. So there's a picture. The Old Testament just... Now, I probably have not exhausted the ways that we can use the Old Testament. That's the ways that I could think of, but that should get across to us that indeed we need to be studying our Old Testaments. You know, I'm just like Paul. I believe all things in the law and in the prophets. That's what he said in Acts chapter 24, verse 14, when he was standing there to be judged and had been accused of being a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he said, "This I confess to you." This is Acts 24, verse 14. "That according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets." I'm like Paul. I believe everything written in the law and of the prophets, every bit of it. But as Paul, I know that I cannot be justified by keeping it. I know that to attempt to so do is to cut myself off from Christ and to fall from grace. Now that's serious. Galatians chapter 5, verse 4. Galatians chapter 5, verse 4. "You who attempt to be justified by the law, you are estranged from Christ. You have fallen from grace." So we cannot attempt to be justified by keeping that law. What we would conclude is, as Paul concluded in Galatians chapter 2, verse 16, "Knowing that a man is not justified by the law, but by faith in Christ Jesus, even we have believed in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by the law. For by the works of the law, no flesh should be justified." Don't bring to me what the law says is something I must obey. Bring it to me in the ways that the inspired writers of the New Testament show us that we ought to use, and it is for our use. Brother Lynn, I believe number 319 is your number. There may be somebody in the audience needs to make your life right with God. Go ahead and open your songbooks there and be ready to sing, please. And we will turn to number 319 and sing that as a song of encouragement.